Chapter 13. Improvisation. Kalis knelt.
"How long has he been like this?"
he asked, using the subtle speech of his mother's people.
"Weeks,"
Kalin told his half-brother. Pug lay unconscious in the center of the contemplation glade, at the very spot where he had first been placed, while spellweavers worked around him to keep him alive.
"Tather?"
Kalis asked.
"We think he regains his strength, slowly. The wounds are also healing, slowly."
Kalis regarded the silent magician. His body was covered with huge scabs and scars, with flakes of dead skin peeling off as if burned by the sun. Under the flakes, raw pink skin could be seen. Most of his hair, beard, and brows had been burned away, so he looked even younger than usual. Akela said,
"We've tried mind probes of the most cautious sort, and no one was able to reach him."
Kalis stood.
"We were counting on his holding back until the end."
Kalin said,
"I think he acted imprudently, but that is judging after the fact. At the time he took the risks, he thought the outcome worth it."
Kalis nodded.
"Sinking the Queen's fleet in the deepest part of the Great Ocean would have simplified many of our problems."
He shook his head in regret.
"But I would rather have him standing healthy at Sethanon."
Kalin said,
"Tomas will go to Sethanon." "What of the dragons?"
Kalin looked concerned.
"They doubt Tomas. Not his word, but they doubt his apprehension of the risk. For all their wisdom, only a few grasp the concepts of magic we know to be at play."
Kalis looked at his brother for a long moment, then said,
"May I speak to you alone?"
Kalin moved his hand in agreement, indicating the younger man should follow him. When they were away from the others, Kalis said,
"Miranda." "No word from either Miranda or Macross since they brought Pug back. They went with Tomas to seek information on the demons under the mountains, where you last found them."
Kalis looked off at the trees of Elvendar. He was silent for a long time, and his brother didn't say a word. In the fashion of the elves, Kalin knew the other would say what was on his mind when he was ready. After several minutes of silence, Kalis said,
"I miss her."
Kalin put his hand upon his shoulder.
"You love her?" "In a fashion," said Kalis. "Nothing like among the Elidel. It feels nothing like what I have been told of the recognition. But she found me, back when all this began, and she fills a dark and cold place within me, as no one else has."
"If it is still dark and cold when she is not with you, it is not truly filled."
Kalin sat upon a large rock and said,
"When your father first saw your mother, I was there. I thought him but a boy smitten by the beauty of one without peer. A boy who had no conception of the feelings between a man and a woman."
He sighed.
"I certainly had no idea of what the future would hold."
Kalis had heard the story of his mother's first visit to Castle Crydy, when the Serrani had first threatened the far coast, and of his father's first glimpse of the Elf Queen.
Kalin said, "You are still very young, my brother. You have seen much, experienced much, but you've not begun to understand yourself. In many ways you are human, but in many others one of us. Patience is required in most things. Your father realized that quickly when he first came to us, and for a human boy, those years he spent here taught him much. Father's unique. He possesses knowledge tens of thousands of years old."
"Does he?" said Kalin.
Kalis turned to look at his brother.
Ashen Sugar.
Kalin said,
Macross said something to me a few days before he left. He said Tomas had Ashen Sugar's memories, but that all memories are suspect.
Kalis sighed.
All of this is suspect.
Kalin agreed.
I have stopped looking for reasons when it comes to the enemy.
His eyes took on a distant look.
When your father first came here, after the Rift War and in the years that followed, I presumed to think that the worst was behind us. The war with the Surani was over, and the risk from the Moradel and the open rift calling back the Valharu was at an end.
He smiled a half-smile that Kalis recognized as a mirror of his own.
I now realize that forces much more enigmatic and far more vast than I had imagined were involved. What do you mean?
Asked Kalis, as he sat cross-legged at his brother's feet.
Primal forces are moving, forces next to which the Valharu are minor annoyances. Other forces move to counter them, and I fear you and I, and those we love, may be crushed between them. Have these forces names?
Many, said Kalin. I speak of the gods.
The gods' war?
Asked Kalis.
It is the only explanation that fits all of what we know, and still makes some sort of sense.
The still youthful-looking elf said,
Tomas and I have talked many times about his memories. He counts me among his oldest friends, from that time of the first visit to Crydee. Much of what Tomas remembers is coloured by how Ashen Sugar saw the universe and his place in it. Some of that was tempered by the magic Macross used to place my mind in bond with his, ages ago. But Tomas still must rethink much of what he presumed to be true.
The Chaos Wars.
Kalin nodded.
We can speak of this at length tonight, after we dine with Mother.
Kalis got to his feet as his brother stood. Kalis said,
I do owe her more of my time. It's been years since we've had you here,
said Kalin, without any indictment, but clearly with regret.
It is easy to think we have ages, given our people's heritage. But we both know how fragile life is.
True, agreed Kalis. I promise that should we endure, I will return for a long visit.
Why not to stay?
Kalis shrugged as they walked toward the Elf Queen's court. As they passed through a series of small clearings, many elves who had not yet greeted the Queen's younger son did so. Kalis smiled and returned each greeting, but when the brothers were again alone, he said,
I do not know if my place is here. My life is neither human, nor elf, nor Valharu.
A legacy of magic, said Kalin. You must define yourself, for no one else has the wisdom to do it for you.
He was thoughtful for a moment, then said,
Much as your father has had to do. As long as the mark of the Valharu exists, he will never be free of a certain suspicion.
I understand, said Kalis. They moved into another clearing, this one loud with the voices of children at play. A half-dozen elven youngsters were chasing after a ball, kicking it back and forth.
Football in Elvendar? Asked Kalis.
Kalin laughed.
See those two over there?
He pointed to twin boys, children Kalis had never seen before.
Yes. They taught the others. They are from across the sea. Miranda brought them and their mother here. Their father is now in the Blessed Isles. Have many of those across the ocean reached us?
Not enough, said Kalin as he resumed the walk. The ball shot toward them, and Kalis deftly caught it on the instep of his left boot. With a laugh, he kicked the ball high and stepped under it, bouncing it off his head a few times, then heading it back to one of the children, who caught it on a knee, bouncing it a few times as the other children oohed and aahed. I remember playing on sixth day at Cridy with Marcus, when I'd visit grandmother and grandfather, said Caelus. The twin, who caught the ball on his knee, kicked it to his brother, who passed it to a third child. The twins regarded Caelus with suspicion. He said, You two look very serious. When they didn't reply, Caelin said, They struggle with their natural tongue. Caelus nodded. In the dialect spoken in the Riverlands of Navindus, he said, You play well. Instantly, both boys' faces were illumined with smiles. Will you teach us how to bounce the ball on our heads? Asked one. Caelus knelt and said, I must leave first thing tomorrow, but some day I will come back and teach you. The second twin said, Promise. Caelus said, I do. The boys turned and ran off to resume their game, and Caelus turned to his brother. They asked me if I was telling the truth. They grew up among humans. It has been very difficult for the Osidel. They wrestle with what is natural to us. Learning our ways comes hard. Dryly, Caelus said, That I can understand. You will resolve your struggle, said Caelin, as he motioned for his brother to continue the walk to the Queen's Court. Some day. Caelus nodded and silently added, If I live that long. Ships burned at dawn. Nicholas's fleet had lost sight of the Emerald Queen's northern squadron after sundown the night before, and had turned south, piling on all the canvas the ship's yards could hold. 2 hours later, the entire fleet had swung toward the east and the Straits of Darkness. They had been rewarded with the sight of fires before dawn as they encountered smoking hulls, burned to the waterline and sinking, both Queen ships and Kessian. Lookouts reported fires farther to the west. As the sun rose, Nicholas saw the vast navy that still waited to slip through the straits. He couldn't judge how many had already made the difficult passage, perhaps as many as a third. To the south, fighting was still underway, as Kessian ships from Alariel were engaged with an equal number of the Queen's warships. Captain Reeves said, Where are the rest of our escorts? Nicholas shouted, We have her! To the lookout aloft, he cried, All ships, attack! As the orders were relayed, Nicholas turned to Reeves. We've outrun those ships we were tangling with yesterday, he calculated. We have perhaps an hour to do as much damage as possible before they come into sight. What she's got left here are engaged with the Kessians, and the rest of them are on the other side of the straits. He went to the quarterdeck rail and shouted, Ready, ballistas! Ballista crews ran to the fore of the ship, where a pair of huge crossbow-like engines of war waited. Each could launch an iron-headed missile 3 times the size of a man, used to strike at the waterline or to foul rigging. Instead of the usual missile, though, a special shaft had been designed, one filled with the deadly Quiggan fire oil. To use them was dangerous, for any mistake could result in the Royal Dragon burning to the waterline. Behind him, the attacking fleet, 47 of the original 60 ships he had left Tulan with, fanned out in attack formation. Nicholas's ship lost wind, dropping her speed so the 2 flanks of the flotilla could sweep in from either side, doing the most damage to the huge body of ships milling in the water, almost at a dead stop, waiting for orders to enter the passage. Nicholas shouted, Master of arms! Fire as you bear! The officer in the bow shouted back, Aye, aye, Admiral!
Two of the larger ships at the rear turned to engage, wallowing awkwardly but potentially dangerous. The lookout shouted,
"They bear catapults, Admiral!"
Nicholas said, "So I see," as a huge war engine on the aft castle of the closest ship unleashed its cargo, a huge net of rocks.
"Port your helm, Captain Reeves."
"Aye, aye, sir," came the calm answer, as the net unravelled at the top of its arc, releasing the shower of rocks, each the size of a man's head, or bigger. The more nimble Kingdom ship swerved to the left, and the rocks splashed harmlessly to the right of where Nicholas stood.
"That would have made a fair mess of the rigging, sir," said Captain Reeves. "Take us back to starboard," said Nicholas.
The helmsman did as ordered, and the bow of the warship swung back on line, bringing it to where it would cross to the port of the big ship. They were close enough now that Nicholas could see the catapult crew frantically attempting to reload.
"Bad choice," said Nicholas. "Takes too long to reload, and the men are exposed."
As if reading his mind, bowmen in the rigging began firing on the catapult crew on the enemy ship. The Kingdom's Royal Marines were ground soldiers, yet experienced at fighting aboard ship. They used short bows with good effect. Then the Master of Arms ordered the starboard ballista fired, and it struck the middle of the enemy ship with a fiery explosion. Men screamed, and Nicholas could see the mid-deck was packed with soldiers, many looking sick from the months at sea. At least a score fell over the side, partially or completely on fire. Others frantically and vainly attempted to beat out the fire, but discovered to their horror the secret of Quiggan fire oil. Once it was ignited, only smothering in sand could put it out. Those throwing buckets of water on it were just spreading the flaming oil faster. Nicholas tore his gaze from the grisly sight and looked at their course.
"Hard to port," he said. "It's a mess in close, and I don't want to get stuck in there with no place to turn around. We'll keep nibbling at the edges."
Orders were passed, and other ships in the flotilla did the same, launching their fiery cargo, then turning hard, lest they become entangled with the ships they were attacking. The lookout above shouted,
"There are two war galleys backing oars in the middle of those burning ships there, Admiral."
Nicholas said, "They want to come out and fight, but they have no room to manoeuvre. Let's find something else to burn before they do find a way out." He ordered the flotilla to a southerly course, sailing toward where the Kessians had been battling the invaders. Smoke was beginning to obscure Nicholas's vision.
"Look out!"
"Sir!"
"Keep a watch out for that northern squadron of theirs. If you catch sight of them, I want to know it before you can think."
"Aye, aye, sir."
For an hour they hunted. Men screamed and died, and still the invaders' ships seemed without number. Nicholas had personally fired four ships and was approaching the fifth when the lookout shouted,
"Ships to the north, Admiral!"
"How many?"
"I count at least a score of sails. I count 30, 40.
"It's their northern element, returning to find they've been outrun," said Captain Reeves. Nicholas swore.
"Look at all these fat wallowing barges. We could sink them all day long without danger."
Then the lookout shouted,
"Admiral, those two war galleys have turned and have gotten free of the sinking ships."
"Well, that makes it interesting," said Reeves. Nicholas nodded.
"I could use some more time." "Master of Arms."
"Sir,"
came the reply.
"How stands our arsenal?"
"We have another 40 missiles, Admiral."
Nicholas shouted to the lookout,
"How far do you judge those two ships?"
"Less than a mile, Admiral."
"Reeves, who's to our north?"
Reeves knew the Admiral knew the disposition of the fleet as well as he did, but wanted to hear it from another to help crystallize his thoughts.
"Sharp Squadron, Wells's Squadron, what's left of Turner's group, and a full third of the fast cutters?"
Nicholas said.
Orders! Sharpen Wells are to move to the north and intercept. I want them to harry and delay, but not to engage.
The lookout shouted,
Understood!
And started signalling.
Then I want the cutters to burn those galleys.
Nicholas knew he was sending several of those fast little ships to the bottom. They had limited offensive capacity, but if two or three could get close enough, they could fire those war galleys, while the Kingdom-class warships could sink 3 dozen troop ships each, under ideal conditions.
Acknowledged, sir!
Shouted the lookout, as the first order was received. The carnage continued throughout the morning, and at an hour before noon, word came that the concentration of enemy warships was too heavy. The northern element of the Queen's fleet had ignored Wells and Sharp's squadrons when it became clear they wouldn't engage. Now they were bearing down on the heart of the fighting. Nicholas saw that the cutters had one of the huge war galleys burning, and another surrounded. The concentration of bow fire from the galleys was incredible, a veritable rain of arrows, and these ships manned ballistas. With calm precision, their crews would reload and fire, and each time another of the small cutters was damaged or sunk. Nicholas took one last look at the damage he had done, then said,
Captain Reeves, it's time to run for Freeport.
Captain Reeves didn't hesitate, for he could see another huge war galley that had followed the first two out of the mess of troop ships, now rowing furiously in their direction. Captain Reeves gave orders to the helmsman, and Nicholas shouted,
Master of Arms!
Sir!
Came the reply, hoarse from hours of breathing the stinking smoke of burning oil.
As we bear, I would appreciate your putting a missile down the throat of that galley that's racing toward us.
Aye, aye, sir!
As the ship heeled, the ballista was fired, and the fiery projectile hurled across the gap, striking the forecastle of the approaching galley. Flames exploded across the upper third of the ship's bow, but only those men on deck were killed. Below, the Horator steadily beat his drum, and the galley slaves pulled as the ship bore relentlessly down on the Royal Dragon. Nicholas calculated and decided they were unlikely to get clear of the ship.
Look out!
Aye, sir!
Does she bear a ram?
An ironclad one, sir, at the waterline.
Well, Reeves, said Nicholas, unless we get a sudden burst of wind, I'm afraid I'm about to get your ship sunk.
Always a risk, sir,
came the impassive reply. The men stood calmly watching as the huge warship bore down on them, its bow now completely engulfed in fire. Reeves looked up and shouted,
Trim the topgallants, Mr. Brooks!
His first officer shouted the order, and men quickly tied off ropes and moved yards. The Royal Dragon heeled over, hard to port, as the galley bore down. Nicholas could feel the heat of the flames across the narrowing gap. His marines began firing down into the deck of the enemy ship.
Master of Arms!
Cried Nicholas.
Sir!
See if your marines can distract their helmsman.
Aye, sir!
Without waiting for the order to be relayed, those bowmen aloft started peppering the rear of the enemy ship with arrows. Nicholas didn't know if they could see the enemy helmsman, but he thought it likely an incoming fusillade might cause him to duck and lose hold of the helm. Even a deviation of course by a few yards might spare the Royal Dragon. Nicholas watched in mute fascination as the enemy ship bore down relentlessly on his ship. He could hear the faint thud of the Horator's drum from below decks as he shifted tempo, and he knew the call for ramming speed had been given.
I think you'd best grab on to something solid, Captain Reeves.
Aye, sir.
Then the Royal Dragon moved, slightly, and heeled over even more as the wind freshened. whether it was the incoming arrows or the blinding smoke from the flaming bow of his own ship, the steersman on the galley did not compensate for the speed of his target. The grind of steel against metal accompanied the sight of the Royal Dragon's helmsman being flung from his wheel as the other ship's ram struck hard into the tiller of the kingdom's ship. A low grinding continued, and the flames from the galley fired the dragon's spanker.
"Fire stations, Captain Reeves," said Nicholas evenly.
"Sir,"
said the captain. He started shouting orders, and the crew raced toward the buckets of sand. Men aloft started cutting away rigging to loose the flaming sail. As if being pushed along, the Royal Dragon jumped forward, and another sailor hurried to grab the helm as the helmsman lay stunned.
"Well, Reeves," said Nicholas, "it seems Providence may be with us for a moment."
"Sir,"
said the captain, relief on his face as the two ships separated.
"I hope we don't come that close again any time soon."
"Agreed,"
said Nicholas. Then his eyes widened. He looked down to see the shaft of an arrow protruding from his stomach, and blood beginning to flow down his white trousers.
"Oh, damn,"
he said. His knees gave way. A flight of arrows struck the rigging above their heads as the marines from an enemy ship nearby launched a random attack on the dragon, hoping to strike anyone. Captain Reeves shouted,
"I want best speed!"
Men flew through the rigging, and the kingdom fleet disengaged itself from the struggle.
"Get the admiral below!"
Reeves shouted. A short time later, Nicholas lay on his bunk with the ship's chirurgeon attending to the wound. Captain Reeves entered and said,
"How is he?"
The chirurgeon said,
"Bad, sir. I fear the worst. If we can keep him alive until we reach Freeport, a healing priest may be able to save him. But he's beyond my meager talents."
The captain nodded and returned to the quarterdeck, where his first officer waited.
"Mr. Brooks? We lost the Prince of Krondor, the Royal Swift, and a score of the cutters. We estimate we sank 30 or more of their cargo ships and a half dozen of their war galleys."
Reeves glanced to the stern, where the enemy fleet was now a low black mass on the horizon.
"Is there no end to them?"
"Apparently not, sir."
The first officer asked,
"How's the admiral?"
"Touch and go.
Can we turn to Tulan?"
"No, we must make best speed for Freeport. Those are the orders."
"But the admiral?"
Reeves said, "Those are his orders." He sighed. "We wait a week in Freeport, then we head to Krondor." Softly he said, "Those are the orders."
"What then?"
"I don't know. Until Lord Nicholas recovers, everything rests in Lord Vicor's hands in Krondor."
The first officer saw how troubled the captain was, and felt the same. Prince Nicholas, youngest son of Prince Aruta, had been admiral of the prince's fleet, supreme commander of the Royal Navy in the West, as long as either could remember. He was the man who held the fleet together, and more, he was royalty, the king's youngest brother. For him to die on any captain's watch would be difficult enough, but for him to die when the kingdom needed her fleet at its best was tragic. Reeves, who was Nicholas's second in command, said,
"Orders to the fleet. I'm taking command. Pass word of the prince's injury. Then order best speed for Freeport."
"Aye, sir."
Nacor studied Pug. Kalis asked, "Will he wake soon?"
"Maybe. Maybe not. Who can say?"
The Isolani watched as his student continued to administer the healing energies, aided by the spellweavers of Elvendar. Nacor had dined with Kalis, Kaelin, and their mother the night before, and they had discussed the best course of action. Nakor had agreed to ride with Kaelin to Crydee, where they would use the Serani transport device to get to Krondor. Shopai would remain behind in Elvendar and continue to help heal Pug.
"I wish I knew what was going on in there," said Nakor.
"In where?"
asked Kaelis.
"In Pug's mind. Something is happening, and only the gods know what it is."
Pug floated in a void, and again he knew he was detached from his body. Only this time he had none of the references he had possessed when he had been aided by the elven spellweavers. He didn't even know how he had come into the void. The last thing he remembered was preparing to attack the fleet of the Emerald Queen. Then there had been a blinding flash, and he had found himself floating. He also had some sense that time was passing, but he couldn't tell how long he had been here. In the void there was no way to orient himself, either in space or time. Then a voice came.
"Greetings."
Pug spoke with his mind.
"Who is there?"
Suddenly Pug was someplace else, a realm of shadows, but still without any physical frame of reference. Mountainous figures, dwarfing him to insignificance, ringed his position. They were near enough that he could sense how large they were, but distant enough that he could apprehend their overall shape. They were roughly human in form, but that was a generous use of the term human. Each rested upon a gigantic throne. Pug sensed these figures were living, though they resembled nothing so much as figures carved from a dark rock of unknown nature. Pug attempted to see detail, but it was as if his mind wouldn't hold the image of what he saw. He turned from figure to figure, and as he thought he recognized a detail, it would flee.
"Who spoke?"
he asked aloud, but no words echoed in the air. He heard his voice in his own mind, but the sound was absent. A figure emerged from the surrounding gloom, a figure robed in black. Pug waited patiently as the figure approached, and at last she removed a veil that hid her features. Pug asked,
"Do I know you?"
"We have met once before, magician,"
came the icy voice, and Pug felt physical pain as it ran through him like a frozen blade.
"Limbs Kragma,"
he said. The goddess nodded. Pug looked around and said,
"But this is not your realm."
"Everything is within my realm, eventually," said the goddess of death. "But it is not the place of our previous meeting, magician."
"Who are these mountainous figures?"
The goddess held out her hand.
"These are the seven who control."
Pug nodded.
"Where are we?"
"We are in the realm of the gods," said the goddess. "This is what you thought you saw when you sought to tear Macross the Black from within the mind of Sarig."
She waved her hand, and a faint image of the celestial city sprang up, surrounding the lower third of the mountainous seven greater gods.
"But that, like this, is simply another level of perception. Despite your powers, nearly unmatched for a mortal, you have not the ability to truly apprehend our reality."
Pug nodded. "What am I doing here?"
"You are here to make a decision."
"What?"
"To live or to die."
Pug said, "Is that a decision to be made?"
"For you, magician."
She placed her hand upon his shoulder, and, rather than discomfort, he felt a strangely soothing touch.
"You will never enter my realm unbidden, for to you has fallen a curse."
"Curse?"
"You will not realize it at first, but eventually you will know it for what it is.
I don't understand.
The goddess put slight pressure on Pug's shoulder and walked him forward slightly. Other figures came into view, and Pug could see that most of them stood motionless, with eyes closed. One or two had their eyes open and regarded them as they passed.
"This is the closest a mortal may come to viewing the gods, Pug of Cridy."
Pug glanced at the goddess and saw that she again looked as she had when he and Tomas had first visited her hall years before, but smaller. On that visit she had towered over them both.
"How is it this time we are of equal size?" "It is a function of perception," she said, stepping away from him.
Instantly she towered over him as she had before.
"Now look at the controllers."
Pug did, and all he could see were the foundations of the greater god's thrones. They appeared a distant range of peaks, nothing more, their tops lost in the dim sky. Then the goddess returned Pug to the size he had been when they first met.
"What have you to say to me?" he asked.
"You are at a nexus. You have three choices. You may release your hold on life now and enter my realm. You will be rewarded for the good that you have accomplished. Or you may choose eternal life."
"As did Macross."
"Macross makes assumptions about his existence that are not valid. The sorcerer's fate is not what he thinks it to be."
"You said I have three choices."
"The third is that you can escape the curse and return to living now. But you shall know the loss of those you love, the pain of thousands, and the sting of bitter failure at the end of your life. You will die in futility."
Pug said, "You paint three difficult alternatives."
"I will tell you this, Pug," said the goddess. "Your position in our universe is unique. Macross unlocked your potential as a baby before leaving you where you would be found. He ensured that your Serrani training would be modified so that you would return to the greater magic of Midkamia, and he saw to it that you survived the Rift War. Because of the sorcerer's interference over the centuries, you play a role far more critical than your birth would have predicted. You stand poised to shake pillars upon which gods rest. This cannot go unnoticed." But in doing this, he also created other situations, ones you know nothing of. And as a result, you must eventually pay the price for his meddling. And at the end of your life, that price will be terrible.
Pug didn't hesitate. "You leave me no choice. A terrible foe stands on the brink of destroying everything I love. I must live."
"Then I will help you live. You will know things, and you must act."
She placed her hand upon his face, covering his eyes. Suddenly Pug felt the void around him tear, and a great pain shot through his body. He sat up, a dry scream ripping from his throat. Nakor held him.
"Drink this."
A bitter brew of herbs touched his lips, and Pug drank deeply. He blinked and found his entire body throbbed with pain.
Nakor said, "This will lessen your suffering."
Pug focused his mind, and the pain subsided.
"I can deal with pain," he said,
and his voice was a stranger's.
"Help me to my feet."
Shopai, Kalis, Kaelin, and Aglarana stood nearby as the magician got to legs shaky with weakness. A robe was brought, and Pug said,
"I seem to be the worse for wear." "You will heal," said Nakor. "A good healing priest can even rid you of the scars."
He touched the magician's cheek.
though it seems you're managing well enough on your own. Some day we must talk about your abilities."
Pug smiled and his face hurt.
"Sometimes I think the same of you."
Nakor also smiled.
"We came to take a last look at you before saying farewell."
"Good. Where are you going?"
Kalis said, "Nakor and I are bound for Crydee. Anthony has one of the old Surani transport orbs, and we are going to use that to get to Krondor."
Pug said,
"Let me rest this day, and tomorrow we'll all three go straight to Krondor."
He glanced around.
"How long since I was injured?"
2 months, said Nakor.
"What's the date?"
2 days past Banapis, said Kalis.
"Then the Emerald Queen's fleet?"
"At the Straits of Darkness,"
answered the Elf Queen's younger son.
"Anthony gave me a viewing lens made from air, and we watched."
Pug said,
"Miranda? Macross?"
He glanced at the group.
"Thomas?"
"When you were injured, they went to look for answers under the Ratangari Mountains," said Kalis. "Will you join them?"
Pug said,
"I don't think so. You and I need to go somewhere else."
"Krondor?"
"First. Then we must go to Sethanon."
Kalis said, "I have much to do before I set foot in Sethanon."
"No," said Pug. "You must go with me to Sethanon."
"How do you know?" asked Kalis.
Pug said,
"I have no answer. I just know this to be true."
Looking at the Elf Queen, he bowed.
"Lady, when your husband returns, please let him know that is where we will be."
Aglarana nodded. "First, you must eat and rest. You've been kept alive by magic arts, and your body is not strong."
"A fact I am painfully aware of," said Pug,
as his eyes rolled up and he collapsed into Nakor's arms.
Consciousness returned slowly, but at last Pug awoke, finding Chopai sitting watch with him.
"How long?"
"Another day, a night, and most of this day."
Pug sat up. His skin itched and his muscles protested, but he found that while still weak, he no longer felt unable to function. He rose unsteadily and looked around. He ran his hand over his chin and felt the stubble of beard returning. He had been moved to a small room, carved from within the bole of a huge oak, and found, stepping beyond a heavy curtain, that it opened into the private garden of the Queen and Thomas. Aglarana sat with her two sons in calm discussion. Kalin said,
"Welcome."
Pug sat down slowly, allowing Chopai to hold his elbow.
"My thanks for all you've done," said Pug.
"We only aid those who are fighting to preserve this," said the Queen, motioning with her hand to indicate all of Elvendar.
"A bit more than that," said Nakor, entering the glade. "The entire world."
The Elf Queen said,
"For the Elendil, Elvendar is the world."
Nakor sat down next to Pug and regarded him.
"You'll live."
"Thank you. I needed the reassurance," said Pug dryly.
Nakor laughed.
"When do we leave for Krondor?"
Pug glanced at the falling light.
"It's evening there already. We should leave first thing tomorrow."
"Another night's rest will help you," said Chopai.
"Besides, Nakor," said Pug, "you and I need to discuss some things."
Kalis said,
"Such as?"
Pug said,
"Some things, I'm sorry to say, must remain between Nakor and I."
Kalis shrugged.
"That's as it should be. But I will be glad to return to Krondor. There is still a great deal left to do."
Pug said, "You must go to Sethanon." Kalis's gaze narrowed.
I have duties.
Be that as it may, you must be in Sethanon.
My father?
Asked Kalis. He may have something to do with this, but I think it's something only you are capable of seeing done.
What is that?
Asked the queen. Pug sighed. I don't know. Nakor laughed, a loud, long guffaw.
That sounds like something I would say.
Pug shrugged. I can't say how I know, Kalis, but you must be in Sethanon at the end, and you can't risk not getting there, which means we cannot have you in the battle. You must go straight to Sethanon, now. Kalis looked torn. Pug and his father were nearly legendary figures, men whose wisdom and power were undoubted. But he had seen to the forging of the prince's defences, as much as William, James, or the others.
But there are so many things for me to do.
There are many men to do those things, said Nakor. But if Pug is right, there is only one man who must be at Sethanon when the battle ends.
Why?
Asked Kalis.
We will know when the time comes,
said Nakor with his nearly ever-present grin. All will be made known to us. Kalis said,
What of the others? My father, Macross, and Miranda?
Nakor shrugged.
They have their own concerns, I am sure.
Macross said, Whenever I think I've seen everything there is to see, something new and perplexing shows up.
Miranda and Tomas were forced to agree as the demon shifted its weight uncomfortably upon the ground. They had been communicating with it constantly since it had spoken and had revealed problems. The demon itself appeared to be nearly mindless, but some other intelligence was in control. The problem was that this intelligence was limited in how much of the demon's nature it could stem. Twice Macross and Miranda had been forced to restrain the creature and listen to it howl in rage for days. But at the end of a month of give and take, all parties had arrived at a clear understanding. The demon was controlled by a being named Hanam, a Saar lawkeeper from the Saar homeworld of Shyla. Between the four of them, Macross, Hanam, Miranda, and Tomas, they had pieced together a picture of events. A dark power, vaguely known to Macross and Miranda, but whose name was hidden from them, had influenced the priests of a city called Arsart, manipulating them into opening an ancient barrier between the demon realm and this one. The demons had come into the world of Shyla, destroying an ancient empire and everyone in it. The Pantathians had shown up in providential fashion, offering the remaining Saar refuge on Midkamia in exchange for a generation's service, 30 Midkamian years. For half that time, the Saar had been growing in power on the continent of Nevindus, then aiding the Emerald Queen in conquering the entire continent in anticipation of this attack on the kingdom. Miranda sighed.
We have, it seems to me, two options.
Which are? Asked Tomas.
Reveal the betrayal of the Saar by the Pantathians, allowing them an honourable avenue to withdraw from the war, or find this entrance from the demon realm and close it.
Tomas said, We must do both. Macross said, I don't like this choice, but Tomas is right.
Can we do one, then the other?
Asked Miranda. The voice of the demon still sounded like grinding rock, but Hanam said,
The demon's king, Marg, rages, and has destroyed many of his own in frustration. He does not know the Pantathians have ceased to exist as a force.
Pointing with a clawed talon toward a distant tunnel, he said,
The rift between Shyla and this world is but a half-day's walk from here. But on the other side of that rift waits Tugor and his minions."
The demon stretched his arms, now reaching 9 feet from talon to talon, and said,
"I am half his size, and I lack his demon's cunning."
Tomas said, "A demon lord I can best." "But it's the numbers," said Macross. "Save the demon king himself, none of that realm is the match of any single one of us." He glanced at his daughter. "Including you, I think, if you keep your wits."
"Thank you for that," she said dryly.
"But a dozen or more of them at once?"
Macross shook his head.
"That's a different matter."
Tomas said, "We delay, yet every day we spend here makes this a more difficult set of tasks." Macross said, "There are times when strength aids, and times when stealth does." He held up one finger. "Tomas, you are vital to the defense of Sethanon. I suggest you and Hanam attempt to divert the Sar."
Tomas said, "Can we get close enough to—"
He glanced at Hanam for a name.
"Jatuk, son of Jawa."
"Jatuk, to let him know of the betrayal.
And will he believe a demon and a Valharu?"
Macross shrugged. Hanam said,
"If I can get him to listen. I know things only the Lawmaster of the Sar would know. If I can speak to Shadu, my student who took my place, I know I can convince him it is his old master who resides in this body."
"What of you?" asked Tomas.
Macross said, "My daughter and I need to close the pathway between the demon realm and here. Eventually, Marg will deduce he has been betrayed by one of those he sent through, even if he doesn't know which captain it is." "Once Marg realizes he's been betrayed," said Hanam, "his rage will be without equal. He will launch a blind attack through the rift, ignoring however many of his servants die for the effort. But once he has reached this world, the outcome will be the same as it was on Shyla. Eventually, you will all go to the feasting pits."
Tomas said, "Do they suspect what is waiting at Sethanon?" One of the longest debates that had gone on between Tomas and Macross had been over how much to tell the Sar Lawmaster. Eventually, it had been necessary to tell him everything.
"No," said Hanam. "Jakan knows only that he took over an army in the middle of a war of conquest and destruction. That is as much his nature as anything else. He eats one of his own every night to keep up his power, and his men think they still go to the arms of the Emerald Queen. I suspect his ambition is to devour this world, and eventually return to challenge Marg. But if he should find this lifestone, he may attempt to seize it, thinking it a great prize. Who knows what may happen then?"
Macross sighed. "We are decided. Tomas, you must take our taloned friend here and convince his former student to listen."
"There is one other thing," said the Lawmaster in demon form.
"What?"
"You must destroy me as soon as Jatuk is convinced. For this body and mind are a struggle to control, and I do not know how much longer I can maintain my dominance of them. It was long in gaining, but it may be over quickly."
"Wonderful," said Miranda as she stood. Macross said,
"We will first find the rift into Shyla. Then we will cross over into that world and find the entrance in the city of Arsart, and close that." "Unfortunately," said Hanam, "there is one thing you're overlooking."
"What is that?"
"Marg may be already on the world of Shyla. If so, to close the entrance to the demon realm, you will first have to kill the Demon King."
Macross looked at his daughter, and neither could think of anything to say.